Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our second case on the calendar is A18-2107, Friends to Restore St. Mary's LLC versus Church of St. Mary et al. Counsel for appellant, as you know, please feel free to have a seat. You'll have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by a respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. Feel free to adjust the podium up and down for each of you. Notice there's a slight height disparity there, so certainly feel free to take advantage of that. Counsel for each parties, when you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
If it may please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Eric Hansen, and I'm here on behalf of Friends to Restore St. Mary's LLC. The matter before you today involves the scope of the application of the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine. And in this matter, the district court erred by applying an overly broad understanding of what the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine is designed to protect against, and ultimately erred in its analysis of whether or not this matter involved an excessive entanglement with government and religion. And because of that error, we're here today asking the court to reverse the district court and remand the matter for a decision on the Mira claim that was before the district court. I think that it's hopefully something the court picked up in the initial order. This was bifurcated, essentially, in the district court. Basically, the parties agreed that we would have cross motions, summary judgment on the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine. And so a lot of the Mira analysis did not take place.
Well, is there any dispute? I don't see there being a dispute that this particular church building is a natural resource as defined by Mira. So then don't we get to the issue of affirmative defense and whether the respondents could flesh out that affirmative defense without entangling the court with their own ecclesiastical decision-making process?
Respectfully, I think that's a question better put to my opponents. I will say that my recollection is that there were at least some noises made early on in the case that, well, it was on the National Register, but perhaps expert testimony would subsequently say that the fire did sufficient damage that it would no longer be National Register eligible listing, and our National Register eligible, and would be delisted from the National Register. And I also do want to make the point fairly clearly that Powderly Archibald, that line of cases, National Register listing is the criteria at which the court looks to, but it is. I don't believe that they are exactly the same. Just because something is on the National Register automatically every time means it is a historical resource within the meaning of the statute.
But assuming for purposes, I think, of the district court's decision and the issue before us, we really do get to the question of whether the Mira claim could be adjudicated by the civil courts because of the respondent's affirmative defenses.
I think that that certainly the court could draw that conclusion, and I think that it's a fair conclusion to draw on this record. But I do think that this issue really goes to whether or not the church is going to raise an affirmative defense, that there is no feasible or prudent alternative to the demolition. And I believe that that issue really probably should be better fleshed out than it is in this action. And
how would we flesh that out without walking down the road of how this group of respondents came to the decision that this church would be demolished as opposed to rebuilt and continued to be used as a worship space?
Okay. Well, I want to, if I may, I want to separate several of those pieces out, because first of all, I want to be crystal clear. we're not here challenging the decision to not restore the church as a church. It is not going to be a church ever again. And that is decided. And I believe that if we were here today saying you have to hold worship space in this building, that that would be barred by the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine. That is not what we are saying. We're saying that this building that once upon a time was a church is a historical resource within the meaning of the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, and that's all we're saying. And then the test under MIRA goes to, is there no feasible or prudent alternative to its demolition? And if the court reads the case law on that, that's not an individualized, does this owner have some other plan for this property? It's, can this property ever be something other than what it is, or is it so far gone that we have to tear it down?
Doesn't that miss a step in the decision-making process?
I believe not, but...
Isn't it really the decision of the bishop to decide whether or what to do with that building?
It is, and MIRA, whether this was an ecclesiastical owner or not, MIRA doesn't compel that. If imagine for a second, Bob Jones owns a historical building. MIRA doesn't say, Bob Jones, you got to decide what to do with this, or you got to restore it. All MIRA does is it empowers citizens to step in and say, that building is historical and should not be demolished. But there is nothing that compels them to restore it, to maintain it, to do anything.
I understand that, but isn't it really the initial decision by the bishop as to whether to restore it or to demolish it? Isn't that really the key issue here of that decision? And that decision is made according to canon law, according to Catholic tradition, and all the aspects of that. I mean, isn't that really ultimately the decision that we're looking at?
I would say it is not.
Why not? That's quite frankly where I'm struggling.
And I want to tease a couple of those pieces apart, if I may. First of all, the decision, if the court looks to the decision, I want to point you to a couple specific documents in the record, 25 and 26. There's letters, April 5th of 2017 and April 7th of 2017. And what it is are...
25 and 26 of your addendum?
Respectfully, Judge, we had some issues with how the document citations were transferred up from the district court. I believe those would be the document numbers assigned by the Court of Appeals, the number 25 and 26, were the document numbers assigned to the district court record when it was transferred to Your Honor's court.
So, just to clarify, are those part of your addendum that you submitted?
They are not part of the addendum. I believe that they're at least one of them is in my opponent's addendum, the April 5, 2017 letter. It's a five-page letter from what we refer to as the DBC, the Diocesan Building Commission. Okay, what that letter says is that this building, even if restored, is not going to serve the needs of the congregation. And then goes on to say, what we need is a new building. And the follow-up letter, Bishop Kettler says, proceed with building a new building. What it doesn't say is, and we have to tear down the old one. That isn't in this record. In fact,
isn't it in the affidavit of the... the Vicar General, I'm looking. I understand Bishop Kettler's affidavit does not, I mean, it references a number of decisional points. It does not in itself say, it's my decision to destroy the building. But that is referenced in Reverend Rolfe's affidavit that, in fact, that was the decision of the bishop to demolish the church building. And we know there's a need for a cemetery, and I mean, I don't know where it goes from there, but I think it's undisputed that the decision was to demolish. That's why you started the lawsuit, right?
Well, and let's be clear on what the record is. Paragraph 45, I think,
right,
is the reference that you are referring to.
Right.
Ultimately, it isn't his decision. It's Bishop Kettler's decision. about whether or not to demolish the church.
Right,
okay?
And the reference in here is that the decision by Bishop Kettler to demolish the church building and new one is a decision that impacts faith and mission.
Except for that decision was never made by Bishop Kettler. There was a decision made.
But it's referencing the decision made by Bishop.
Respectfully, it's an affidavit submitted for litigation. The decision by Bishop Kettler was to build a new church. That was the sum total of the decision. And I think that it's important that the court understands the distinction because they're seeking to blur two things, one of which I think falls within the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine, whether or not you're going to have religious services in this building anymore. The second question of whether or not you're going to tear down this building, that they've said they're not going to have religious services anymore, that's not a question that bears on the faith and mission of the Catholic Church.
Again, I'm not sure I agree with that point because this was a church. It wasn't just a random building. It was a place of worship, and it was a specific place of worship for the Catholic Church. So how do you separate this building, which was under the Catholic law, is considered a religious building, has a religious artifacts in there, has been consecrated? How do you separate that out from that?
Because of the record that we have, they've already made that decision.
Who are you referring to when you say they, and what is the decision that you're referring to?
The diocese, through the action of Bishop Kettler, determined that there was going to be a new worship space.
Isn't there something in the record about this, the old building, having some religious significance, even as the new space becomes the new church? That is, that there's a recommendation somewhere that they would have a service that would include both buildings?
There's some broad discussion of things that they could do if they so chose.
But those things suggest that the building, even though it's damaged, still has significance to the church and to the bishop.
Okay, but I respectfully think that that's not the question that I think is before this court. The question is, can you apply neutral principles of law to decide if there is no feasible and prudent alternative to the demolition of this building? Because the building is not going to be a church, and that's the record here, in that it once was a church.
That was, I think, my question, though. I think it still does have some, as I understand what the record is, it does still have some significance even in its damaged state and prior to and right up to demolition, according to the bishop.
And that's where I think I would respectfully disagree with you. Once the decision is made, it's a building. Just the church, as in the Catholic Church, this diocese, owns a number of buildings. School, if it could be a warehouse, it is within the bishop's purview to decide what to do with this building.
And it's, as I understand it, the record reflects that this building has not been deconsecrated at this point.
I don't recall that the record reflects that. I do believe there is some information in the record that says that it would have to be that under City of Melrose building ordinances, because it hasn't been used as a worship space for more than a year, that it basically automatically is not a worship space, and that they would have to go back to the city council as part of reconstructing it.
But doesn't canon law describe the process the church goes through in evaluating whether a worship space can, consistent with canon law and consistent for the respect we have for the fact that this building has been a worship space, that is a decision that affects the faith life of the diocese?
It is, and we aren't seeking to interfere with it. That decision has been made.
So as a practical matter, if we agree with you, what happens? I think you agree that the court cannot evaluate the church's or the respondent's bishop's diocese decision not to use it as a worship space.
Correct.
So then what would the court be doing? Just requiring it that it remain in its damaged state and that you would preclude the diocese from using the property or the building for any other purpose?
All MIRA does is provides an avenue for protecting a historical structure from being torn down. So all we are looking for out of the district court is an order saying you cannot demolish this building. They could do with it whatever they want. They remain the property owners. All MIRA does is impose this, and let me give you a concrete example.
The church can never destroy it, is your argument, because of MIRA.
Any owner can't destroy it, just like the Minneapolis Armory. Okay, Minneapolis Armory, the Canapin government set out to destroy that, to build a jail.
And so MIRA trumps any First Amendment concerns that the church may have in terms of whether a destruction of this building or reuse of this building by a secular organization or a different way would undermine their faith principles.
It doesn't transfer ownership. So the church still has control of how this space is used, other than they can't demolish it and put a parking lot in. That's all MIRA does, and that's all we're asking for. I see my time has expired. Hopefully I can answer your questions a bit better on rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Council for respondent.
Your Honors, my name is Siri Van Heck. I'm here with Cooper Ashley, and we represent the respondents in this matter. Your Honors, the day that St. Mary's burned in an arson fire was a tragedy for the entire St. Mary's community. The church that was the spiritual home of the parish community was catastrophically damaged. I'd like to point the court to a couple of important facts here. The church here was burned and gutted in a fire and continues to deteriorate and burden the respondent's spiritual resources. It was this damage to the church that prompted and required respondents to engage in an extensive analysis under canon law. This analysis included establishment of a steering committee by the parish priest to consider potential options for restoration of the church, submission of a written proposal for restoration to the Diocesan Building Commission pursuant to diocesan policy, analysis of the liturgical issues with respect to the restoration of the church under canon law and Catholic doctrine by the DBC, and recommendation by the DBC that the restoration be denied and a new church be built.
And I don't think Repellent challenges any of that. I mean, and I think he said, you know, those kinds of decisions are appropriately within the, you know, the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine. That's not the relief that the appellant is seeking under MIRA. What they're just saying is don't destroy the old building. You don't have to use it. We're not going to tell you you have to use it for a worship space. But it's a natural resource and needs to be preserved.
Correct, Your Honor. And I wanted to address a point that you brought up on appellant's argument, and that is that the court here today doesn't have to consider whether or not this is a historical resource. Respondents don't submit that it is a historical resource. However, it's really not necessary to address that. So assuming today, for purposes of argument, that it is a historical resource, the problem with the MIRA analysis comes to the fact that when the respondents will be required to determine whether or not there's a feasible and prudent alternative to demolition that will require the district court to step into the shoes of a diocesan bishop and consider the canon law analysis that went on here. So essentially, there are only two options for a prudent and feasible alternative to demolition. The first one is that it can continue to be used as a worship space, and the parties agree that that's not an appropriate analysis. The second potential conclusion that the court could come to is that the church could continue to be used for another secular purpose. However, as was made evident in the district court's decision and is also in the record, the decision of whether or not to relegate a building that can no longer be worshipped in to a secular use does require the application of canon law by the bishop. And the district court put that in its order. That's canon 1222. So the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine here is really meant to address precisely the issue that's going on between appellant and respondents. The initial case addressing this issue was Jones v. Watson, and in that case, it was a dispute between parishioners inside of a church. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Field v. Matthews says that a court may decide disputes involving religious organizations if they can resolve the matter relying on neutral principles of law. It does not disturb the ruling of a governing ecclesiastical body with respect to issues of doctrine, and adjudication does not interfere with an internal decision that affects the faith and mission of the church. And the district court had it absolutely right in their decision that they can't rely on neutral principles of law here, because under prudent and feasible analysis, they're going to end up running into what did the bishop already decide for this space. Second,
and that's my question, what did the bishop already decide? Has there been a decision that this building is going to be deconsecrated and used for some other secular, non-profane, or whatever the language of the canon law, I don't recall it specifically. But has that, if that decision hasn't been made, and the only decision is we're just demolishing this building, how is the court's review of the demolition decision going to implicate anything if the other use of that building hasn't even been considered by the bishop?
Your Honor, I submit to the court that the issue has been decided, and I would point you to Reverend Rolfus's affidavit at paragraph 45. As the Vicar General, he serves as the mouthpiece for the bishop and executes his executive authority under canon law. So it would be appropriate under canon law for Reverend Rolfus to assert that the bishop has made that decision. Also,
does the bishop's affidavit say that?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't explicitly state that. However, I would also submit to the court that for purposes of this argument, to build a new church will require them to tear down the old one, because there is a continued depletion of the resources, both spiritual and financial, because this building remains standing. In addition, I would also like to point the court to the affidavit of Jerry Ostendorf that was submitted in support of appellant's response below. And in that specific affidavit at paragraph 26, he states that the bishop has made the decision to demolish the church. Your Honors, I would also like to point out that there are two other grounds on which the court can affirm the district court's decision here today. An application of MIRA, as applies to this case, also violates the Freedom of Conscience Clause of the Minnesota Constitution. The court in State v. Hirschberger explained that Minnesotans are afforded even greater protection for religious liberties under the Minnesota Constitution than under the U.S. Constitution. In analyzing Freedom of Conscience Clause claims, the court considers four factors. Number one, whether the objector's belief is sincerely held. Two, whether the state action burdens the exercise of religious beliefs. Three, whether the state's interest is overriding or compelling. And four, whether the state action uses the least restrictive means. Interfering with Bishop Kettler's decision based on canon law that the church cannot meet liturgical requirements and must be demolished is a burden on the exercise of respondents' beliefs. Also, appellant doesn't challenge the sincerity of these beliefs. Further, the express language of the Minnesota Constitution limits governmental interests that outweigh religious liberties to laws concerning peace, safety, and acts against licentiousness, none of which are implicated by a historical preservation statute. Appellant points to language in MIRA that proclaims that the interest of the state in preservation of its natural resources is paramount.
Well, I mean, and that's true. I mean, you look at the case law that counsel for appellant cites, and, you know, entities of owners of property have come forward with all kinds of practical reasons why they don't want to preserve a natural resource, and the courts have uniformly recognized the paramount importance that MIRA places on preservation of natural resources in all their forms. That's a pretty strong government interest, it seems to me, that is a neutral interest. It's not aimed at religion, it's or anything else.
Yes, Your Honor. The statute does say that it's paramount. However, I would also like to point out that the cases that address MIRA claims, in those cases, they weren't sacred spaces and they weren't owned by religious entities. So under the Minnesota Constitution, because this is a First Amendment argument and we're talking about the respondents' religious liberties here, there's really only three government interests that can overcome that under the Minnesota Constitution. Respondents here have provided numerous affidavits from canon lawyers and a Catholic liturgist testifying to the religious significance of the process that the diocese went through that resulted in Bishop Kettler's decision to demolish the church and build a new one. The courts do not consider the validity of a religious belief, only its sincerity. And again, that's not something that's disputed here. So applying MIRA to prevent demolition of the church in direct contradiction to Bishop Kettler's decision is clearly a burden on the exercise of respondents' faith, and one that is not supported by a compelling state interest. Thus, an application of MIRA, as applied to this case, violates the Freedom of Conscience Clause of the Minnesota Constitution. There's one other claim that's in front of the court today that would allow the court here to affirm the district court's decision, and that's the Free Exercise Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Under a free exercise analysis, any government action that infringes upon the exercise of religion is subject to strict judicial scrutiny and must meet a compelling state interest in order to be enforced. It's important to note that Smith II's neutral law of general applicability test doesn't apply in this case. There are two important exceptions where courts are required to apply strict scrutiny in a free exercise case, both of which apply here. Number one, where the law contains a system of individualized exclusions and exemptions. And number two, the so-called hybrid exception, where an otherwise neutral law implicates more than one constitutional protection. In this case, freedom of religion and freedom of speech. This is a case of first impression in Minnesota, but I would like to direct the court to two other cases in other jurisdictions that inform the analysis today. Those two cases are Mount St. Scholastica v. City of Atchison and Keeler v. City Council of Cumberland. In both of those cases, Catholic parishes claimed violations of the Free Exercise Clause based upon the use of historical preservation laws to prevent demolition of a variety of buildings, not just churches. The courts in both cases held that strict scrutiny applied because in each case, historic preservation laws created a system of individualized exclusions and exemptions. Importantly, when the court looks at whether or not a law has a system of individualized exclusions and exemptions, what it's looking to is whether or not the court is looking at individual circumstances.
And so your argument would be the fact that MIRA provides an affirmative defense that there is no alternative to demolition that is feasible and prudent. That, in your argument, is the individualized nature of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you look at the language of the Mount St. Scholastica case, the historic preservation ordinance there used exactly the same feasible and prudent language that the MIRA statute does here. In both of these cases, the courts ultimately found that the free exercise clause was violated because the historic preservations had never been found by any court to be a compelling state interest under the federal constitution.
Now, the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine, at least as it's been applied historically, including in Minnesota, has been grounded in the Establishment Clause.
Yes,
are you suggesting that that is not the case, that the law has changed? What's your argument on that?
No, Your Honor. I would submit that the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine has always been, has been analyzed primarily under the Establishment Clause set of cases. And in that case, when you're looking at a Lemon analysis, you're going to look at whether or not there's excessive governmental entanglement with religion. And as was made clear in the district court's decision, it is here, because Bishop Kettler's decision under canon law is what governs the prudent and feasible analysis. Your Honors, I'm going to briefly conclude.
And just one last question along those lines. I mean, if we, do we even need to get to the last two issues, or can we just decide this under the Establishment Clause?
Your Honor, I do not believe you need to get to the last two questions. I think that the court may affirm based on the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine analysis here. In conclusion, appellant is attempting to use a civil historic preservation statute to prevent respondents from raising a severely damaged church that, even if restored, cannot comply with Catholic liturgical standards and directly interferes with Bishop Kettler's decision to raise the church pursuant to canon law. Respondents provided uncontroverted affidavits establishing that the application of MIRA to prevent demolition of the church interferes with and infringes upon the exercise of respondents' beliefs. Finally, historic preservation here is not a compelling state interest under either the Minnesota or the U.S. constitutions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Van Heck. Mr. Hansen?
So I think what's important for the court to understand here is that the feasible and prudent alternative analysis does not require this court to substitute its judgment for any ecclesiastical decision maker. And in fact, if the court looks to the other cases in the MIRA range, it doesn't even look to who the current property owner is. And I tried to articulate this point earlier, but if you look at the decision in Powderly, ultimately, Powderly was a gas station that bought some row houses and they wanted to build a parking lot. And the court stepped in and said, no, you can't demolish these row houses. That gas station, there's nothing in the record to suggest that they were suddenly interested in becoming landlords of these row houses. That's the analysis, and it is a neutral analysis.
Well,
and
but didn't, like, Arkball, I mean, that was the Minneapolis Armory. And
yes.
And the city wanted to, or was it the county of Hennepin that wanted to build a new jail there?
Right.
And that was going to be the best site. I mean, so there is, and part of the analysis the court made as a factual matter is that there were other places you could put a jail, and lo and behold, they did find another place for a jail. But, I mean, isn't there some, in looking at reasonable and feasible and prudent alternatives, there is some attention given to the particular owner and what alternatives that owner might have.
I would disagree with that. I think that if you read the MIRA cases carefully enough, what they say is reasonable and feasibly prudent alternative really means, is there anything that anybody can do with this building? Not this owner, not what they had planned to do. And there's language in there that I think is important that I think they've been dancing around, which says, so the Supreme Court says, as you undertake the reasonable, prudent, feasibly prudent alternative test, you cannot consider whether or not it costs a whole pile more. Money can't be the deciding factor as to why it's not reasonable and feasibly prudent.
But are any of these cases involving sacred spaces?
They are not.
And should there be a different, would the MIRA apply differently in that context?
And I would argue, I would make two points. One, this isn't a sacred space anymore. And that's undisputed on this record. It is not a sacred space. They've moved on.
There seem to be some reference in the record to the use of this space to assist in the transition to a new facility in the church service.
Then I would say that if that's your conclusion, then respectfully, I think that if you followed the case law in the Islamic Society decision, that there is a means to deal with that. Islamic Society talks about if the district court is working its way through this analysis and ultimately concludes, yes, this requires me to decide whether or not this is a faith decision, then the court can say, I can't adjudicate this. We aren't at that point in this case. That, I think, if anything you take from that question is something that the district court should be taking factual findings on and making a decision.
So you're suggesting that the record doesn't support the respondent's assertion that the demolition decision, which was a faith-based decision grounded in canon law, that decision hasn't really been made yet?
It has not been made. And if this may be a very different case, if there was a decision by the bishop that said, under this requirement of canon law, this building was once sacred and can never be anything else, and therefore under our religious faith tenets, we must demolish it. That's not this record.
But
it is absolutely not this record.
It's not. What about the letters that were referenced, that we talked about, paragraph 45 and...
Yes. Judge Reyes, I would ask you to read the actual letters. There is that one sentence in a litigation affidavit that says, and it doesn't say I decided, it says Bishop Kettler decided.
Well
take a look at what Bishop Kettler decided.
The Osendorf affidavit says at paragraph 26, the parish, diocese, and bishop of St. Cloud have made it clear that their intention is to demolish the building.
And they have said that they intend to demolish it. I think that's been said here today. The question is that a question that implicates the faith of the community? Okay, and that's what we're worried about when we talk about the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine.
Right.
We have to make sure that the faith and mission of the church is not impinged.
Right, but I think that ties back to my original question of the decision of whether to use that church or to demolish it. Isn't that one that was based on canon law, based on the recommendation by the committee, taking into account what can be done with that church going forward?
I would respectfully submit that the only thing that is in our record is the ability for Bishop Kettler to decide that the space is no longer sacred and it can be rendered for profane use and not sordid use. And that making that decision isn't in our record. It isn't here. And that is where I think that if that's the concern of the court, the appropriate response is to remand it to the district court to find out.
But then we'd be remanding to, in fact, invite the district court to walk down canon law, wouldn't we?
No.
I mean, if the record seems to be that the decision has been made to demolish, but your argument it is they certainly haven't indicated that that was based on what grounds that was based specifically, remand would, in fact, require the court to engage in that analysis of canon law, wouldn't it?
And I think that, as I read this state's precedent on an ecclesiastical abstention doctrine, it's not so simple as, hey, this implicates a church, so we're going to walk away.
Right.
I don't think Feel says
argument,
that.
Though.
I don't think Islamic Society says that. I think that this is a question that may possibly at some point down the road implicate religious authority, but there's nothing in this record to suggest that. Grant of the summary judgment at this stage and dismissal of these claims was premature, and that should be corrected, and I think that correcting it is important because we have to establish where the lines are, and right now we don't have that because we're making guesses as to what the basis is for the supposed intent to demolish a historic building. MIRA doesn't allow that.
If this is, it seems to be, the first case in Minnesota where MIRA has been up against First Amendment ecclesiastical abstention doctrine issues, what's the rule of law you would have us apply?
I believe that the Islamic Society one case, that precedent does lay out a kind of step-by-step format, and the Supreme Court did talk about that in Feel, although didn't expressly adopt the Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania jurisprudence on that, I think that it requires a very careful searching determination of, is this decision, and in this case, this decision is to demolish this building, one in which it is faith-based. And if it is, then the ecclesiastical abstention doctrine applies. But we don't have that here, not on this record. And given the paramount concern under MIRA, it's appropriate for us to go through the steps and figure that out. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsels. Very well argued and very well briefed as well. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both. Thank you.